I have a practical announcement to begin with. There's a need for volunteers in the kitchen for tomorrow and the next day, and information about that is pinned on the board. Is that the idea? And if you have signed up to do something in the kitchen or elsewhere, please make sure you show up.
Otherwise, you're not going to get any food. And your toilet will be dirty.
So we'll start then with your question from hanging over from yesterday, if it's still relevant.
I have a notion of Tibetan tradition as being a mystical tradition. I wonder.
I'm bowing to my perverse temperament, probably. The question has to do with Tibetan Buddhism. Family has had the impression that Tibetan Buddhism is a very mystical tradition, and for example in Gogyo Rinpoche's book, The Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, that impression has been very much reinforced, and yet in what I've been saying, he seems to get the impression that I'm kind of pointing in a different direction. I think it's actually a mistake to think of the Tibetan tradition as being a very mystical tradition. It certainly contains those elements, but in all of the years that I studied as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, I spent most of that time studying logic, epistemology, philosophy, Buddhist doctrine, Abhidharma, and these are actually the things I benefited the most from. I also did visualize myself as a naked red zucchini and recited mantras and generated mandalas, but that was always, that was a kind of on the side from trying to figure out what was a valid syllogistic argument. So Tibetan tradition, I think, is very rich because it contains, as it were, it contains all of the elements that informed Buddhism around the period of about the 8th century AD in India, in the great universities like Nalanda. So it has a very strong intellectual tradition. That tradition is perhaps more present in the Geluk and in the Sakya school. Sogyo Rinpoche is a Nyingmapa. And the Nyingmapa, the Kagyupa, tend to put more of an emphasis on devotional practices, Vajrayana practices, the Dzogchen, Mahamudra, which are, as you say, more mystically inclined. And I think it's important, I think, to see that there's far more to Tibetan Buddhism than all of the deities and the Ragamatas. And to see it really for one of the few Buddhist traditions that holds that whole range of threads within a Buddhist civilization. Yeah. All right, quickly.
Okay, they all seem to be interested.
Much more to say about it, but I did emphasize that when we talk of practice, I need to imagine that as something far more than just being committed to a particular kind of spiritual exercise, and also to be aware that practice in the wider sense concerns the whole human being, all aspects of ourselves, not just what one might call the mystical or the contemplative, but also the intellectual. It comes back to what I said to Benny as well. And I don't think we can, as it were, kind of segregate the different functions of the human being, the rational and the mystical, as though they're two parts of ourselves. They're always in experience wound up with one another. our capacity to be aware, our capacity to feel, our capacity to think. And these are not reducible to certain kinds of components. We're not a machine. And there's the thinking bit, and there's the emotional bit. And if you want, you can somehow take one bit out when you're doing one practice. It doesn't work like that. And yet I think each practice, each discipline, as it were, requires us to focus on a particular area of our life. I think as Western educated, intellectual people, I think there's a great importance about leaving that in the background somewhat and cultivating qualities of attention, of awareness, kind of sensitivity, but not to think that thereby you've somehow transcended the rationality. You haven't. And as I've mentioned, in order to do any human activity, all of these elements will play some kind of role. And it's more a question perhaps of foreground and background. You can put just mindful attention in the foreground. But in the background, the intelligibility of that practice, which entails the presence of thoughts and ideas and concepts, and so on. Well, it is, and again, I think there's a place for all of these things, and I don't think we want to muddle it up too much. We need to, I spent all those years in that Zen monastery just asking myself, what's this? And I didn't read many books. I certainly wasn't encouraged to read books. And I'd actually kind of burnt out the need to read books after all those years in the certain school. But as that part of myself, as it were, developed, then I found myself coming back to a more integrated a way of being, in which ideas and theories and philosophy were called upon really to somehow enable me to articulate those experiences I've had in those practices of meditation. I didn't say that. I said more. We have a richer resource of materials to understand what dependent origination means.
But I just wanted to, because I was thinking, inasmuch as the living body of my experience is maybe the best.
And that's tomorrow. Okay?
Okay, I try to. That possibility is the only one that has the truth. Now, where normally I think that the nature is and you're telling these five friends, and they understand it, so they are in a certain level of understanding. So when they want to teach the rest of the population.
It's a complicated question.
And maybe the last layer is less complicated. Me as a songwriter, for instance, I think that makes sense.
I really don't think it's as simple as that. There's always an element in these stories and accounts of the Buddha and so on, which is in a sense rhetorical. In other words, certain literary devices are used to emphasize the uniqueness of the Buddha in his own time and has eluded everybody else. Well, all religions do that to some degree. There's a certain sense of wanting to emphasize how special a particular teacher is. In reality, I don't think things are ever that clear cut. And again, if we go back to this Buddha Mara thing, I think all of us, all beings, have both capacities all the time. And to say that somebody is possessed by the devil is, I think, not a language the Buddha would have used. He would have acknowledged that, yes, we're all subject to limitations. We're all subject to certain forces in our life or certain forces in society that close us down. But that doesn't mean that we are kind of beyond hope at all. It means that you could also say that each person is also subject to moments of openness and to kindness and to wisdom and to compassion. All of these properties constitute what we call our humanity. And to sort of split off the Buddha as somehow having all the good bits and everybody else mired in darkness, it may be, you may find sentences like that in the text, but they are really rhetorical passages. So I don't find how that sort of black and white distinction actually corresponds to our actual knowledge of human beings. And Mara, I think, is necessary for enlightenment to happen. You could take Mara to refer to the first two noble truths, if you will, suffering and its origins. Without those, there would be no enlightenment. Mara, therefore, in some respects, is utterly necessary for us to be able to go beyond. The idea of transcendence, of going beyond something, requires something to go beyond. That's Mara. Mara is part of the picture. The danger, and the Buddhist text, I think, inevitably fall into this trap, is they present Buddha is there and Mara is there. They set up a kind of a polarity, a duality. But experientially, things cannot be split that way at all. They're both there all the time, potentially, actually. And that is a way of, it's a metaphorical, a mythological way of trying to articulate the complexity of the human condition.
I would say that, of course, in any religion, you have people who really follow the teaching, and you have some who kind of just freed.
That's the second part of your question.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like in any religion. When I was in Korea, I met a lot of wonderful people. And that they be lay people, I have a friend who is an ordinary housewife, and during the meditation season in Korea for 3 months, he doesn't go to the church to take care of her family, but every morning she gets up at 4 o'clock. And then she do an hour of meditation, then she go and cooks lunch, breakfast for her husband, because this is sacred. And then after he's gone to work, she does more meditation. And to me, I was very impressed to see that dedication, which I've met in monks, nuns, lay people, and also, to judge, these people do it, these people don't do it. Again, there are many different ways.
I mean, I often find to my it was a source of great humility to me to meet two so-called ordinary people who don't know about Buddhism, who don't have any conscious spiritual aspirations, but who embody wisdom, compassion, love in a way that I find humbling, because I don't live up to that myself. I mean, I would say that Buddhism has actually become a religion. Rather than, if you look at the way the monks and the nuns and the lay people lived at the time of the Buddha, there was very little in their behavior that we would recognize as religious in the modern way. But if you go, say, to Bangkok or to Tokyo or to Lhasa, it's religion in space. Golden temples and monks and incense and rituals and devotions and priests, and it's all there. But I feel that's something that evolved or degenerated, depending on what you want to look at, from something that was actually, as Martin says, I mean, more aware. Like, there was a question also, the lady's not here, about Stoicism. What's the connection between Buddhism and Stoicism? I think early Buddhism is much closer, in some ways, to some of the early Greek philosophical schools, which were not intellectual schools, but ways of life, like Pythagoras, Epicurus, the Stoics. The early Buddhist community had that kind of feel to it. But over the course of the centuries, as it adapted and became part of the social structure, the political structure in different parts of India, it became more and more what we would recognize now as a religion. And you take moments in Buddhist history where that's challenged, like the beginnings of Zen, or the beginnings of the Vajrayana in India. Was a kind of reaction against that religiosity, those hierarchies, those power structures. And I feel in our time, I certainly feel we need again to somehow get back to the beginning, both intellectually, philosophically, spiritually, and try to recover something about the early spirit of the tradition, which is not far more, I feel, a way of living in the world, rather than adopting certain belief structures, assuming certain forms of religious behavior.
But you don't want to be religious,
they can't. But again, I'll touch on this a bit tomorrow as well. Yeah.
But in many things, what I'm going to say is, so what I'm going to say is,
this is about the other fact I gave you today about asking what is it. And she tried it in many different ways, in French, in Hebrew. She tried it without verbs, and she says that she cannot ask the question. She seems impolite in a way, kind of
indecent,
nearly, to ask this question. So, what do we say about that? Nobody has ever mentioned that, so that's what you want to mean. This is one method. This is just one method. I think one has to see that actually there are 1,700 different questions one could ask. And what they use is the one we use it because they use it a lot in Korea. It's the main one. So you could ask why teeth on a board. You could ask why teeth on a wooden board.
Why are there teeth on the wooden board?
That is really complicated.
Why teeth on a board?
Why teeth on a board? You could ask why the cypress in the courtyard. You could ask why Dao said no. And off we go. But it seems to us what is it is a little more kind of relevant. And much more fun than why teeth on the board. I'm sure people find ways to do it too. And in a way, this is just a certain technique because in terms of concentration, you come back to the question, but it's not just like a mantra. At the same time, you ask, and you ask because you don't know. This is the main thing. And so what you're trying to develop is a sensation of questioning, like when you lose something. You know, when you go to your car, you go in your pocket, and there are no keys. So you look at one, several times in the pocket, and there are no keys. And you are in this state. Before you start to worry, are they there, and you kind of rush around, you are in this state of scarcity. Where are they? You have no idea. And so this practice is trying to become more familiar with this feeling of scarcity. Because a lot of the time what we do is what we see. We kind of very much go for security, for certainty. I know this. And in a way, this method is likely to undermine that a little, that fixing, that kind of... And so in a way, to ask the question, sometimes... And I think there are three reactions. Not only the first one, I could say. But there are three reactions generally to this question. One type of person, they do the question and they think this is the best thing. They really love it. The next type of person thinks, within about 1 minute, why am I asking this stupid question? And I would tell them, if you feel like this, don't do it. You know, the breath is as good and valuable. And then there's a third type of person who actually the violent support by the question. It rattles them, I can really say. And then I tell them to not do it that much. And so, that's what I would say here. If you feel, you know, it's indecent, it's the question you can't really want to do, then do it, or find another type of question which might work better for you. As long as the question don't lead to proliferation.
What matters actually is not the form of words so much as the sensation, the feeling that they evoke. And so I think, if you can also find out in how you actually phrase the question, play with that, where do you put the emphasis? What is this? Or what is this? Or what is this?
I don't believe that.
But what I'm trying to get to is that the form of words we use, the way we articulate it, it generates a whole range of nuance. And the key is what works to generate this sense of puzzlement, perplexity, and questioning. And once we find that, we can drop the words, actually. They're not so important. The words are like a trigger. They're like a springboard to bring us into a state of doubt, of unknowing and perplexity.
Yeah.
And then, there's no official way to do it that's right. I feel that in the course of our life, life itself presents itself as something fascinating, puzzling, confusing, mysterious, and it kind of strikes us in the belly sometimes. That it may be in, some people might find that when they go out into nature. Others might find it when they're with a young baby. Others might experience it, when they think of evolution, there you go. Others might experience it when they listen to Bach. The important thing really is not at all how you get there, but what works in terms of triggering that primary sense of wonderment and puzzlement about the fact that we're here at all. That's the primary thing. But as a discipline, I found this method to be very effective. But certainly it's not for everyone.
Why is it so hard?
I think it's so hard because it goes against the stream. We spend most of our lives convincing ourselves that we have the answer. And the ego, in a way, is our answer to the question of life and death. We're very invested in remaining me like this. This is who I am and what I believe is right. And that's the very opposite of not knowing, it's knowing. Questioning has as its underbelly a state of not knowing. And you can also, instead of saying, what is this, you can say, I don't know. Whenever you ask a question, even a trivial question, like, what are we having for dinner tonight? Implicitly, you're saying, I don't know what we're going to have for dinner tonight. Otherwise, you wouldn't ask the question. So when we say, what is this? We're also saying, I don't know what this is. So not knowing is just as much part of this practice as is questioning. And yet our lives are very much based very often on, I know who I am, I know what this is about, I know what's right, I know what's wrong. I think it's difficult because it threatens, you said yourself, unsettled. It's
difficult.
Don't do that. If you're looking for something easy, then I suggest that.
Yeah. But you have to find a way with it. I think it's like any method. You have to show it. Some people really don't resonate. Some people feel unsettled. And I think then one has to kind of, see how can I play with it. Is there any element which is useful or not? It's just one method. And over there?
Yes. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. This question will lead, I think, almost inevitably to the question, what is it that asks, what is it? What is it that asks, what is it? Well, then that is what's being questioned, what one might call the witness. But to me that's in a way one of the most interesting things. What is it that asks what is it? I find that once you get into the rhythm of this practice, you find that you don't actually consciously or intentionally choose to ask the question. You find that it is being asked. And it's remaining with that, it's allowing that sense. But yes, that I think is where it goes. Law of nature, maybe.
Law of nature.
I understand what you're saying. There's another thing. Let's go back to the Buddha's enlightenment. It's true that he says in one of the other Pali texts, there are three things that he recognizes at this enlightenment. One is, he says, I understand how beings come into the world and how they pass away. There is very much a notion of the sense of life going on, transforming, people being reborn and dying and being reborn. I take that more, less as a kind of confirmation of reincarnation, but rather just another way of understanding the principle of dependent arising and passing and arising again and passing. And it's true, it's not that once something has passed away, it's somehow finished. It's not. Its life is constantly, as you say, renewing itself. Nothing was ever lost, in a way. In modern science, we'll say that the amount of matter in the universe is constant. Nothing disappears for nothing. Absolutely not. The Buddha doesn't say in the early text that he feels interconnected to the web of life. That may be a way to interpret that, but we don't find that actually in the text. But the other point you make about my reluctance, as it were, to somehow put a label on this bigger picture, is because I do feel that such labels inevitably impose a certain limitation or constraint. They somehow, for me, restrict my sense of the still mystery of all things. I'd rather leave that open and feel that more experientially as something that's constantly pulsing and happening within my experience. The practice of meditation, of attending to that in each moment, is, I feel, for me at least, a way of attuning myself to that process. What's just as important is how that then translates into what I say and what I do and how I live and, as you said, how I write and how I do art and how I live my life. I feel liberated in a way in not feeling a need to talk about a soul or a god or some kind of quasi thing, because I always feel it's inadequate. I feel it's no word, no concept, no term, but doesn't somehow reduce that. And the Buddha, I think, is what I like about Buddhism. I mean, obviously I'm kind of into it. If the Buddha is more concerned with breaking down certain fixations and habits and ways of being that actually limit it. He's less interested in somehow explaining or describing or giving a language for what it's like when you've let go. He's really interested in just getting you to a point of letting go. Yeah. Yeah. I respect that very much. But clearly, I have a different way of thinking about these things. But essentially, yes, I completely resonate with that. It's just not a language that I would personally use. And I'd have no recollection or experience of any of my past lives or anybody else's. It's not something I can really tap into.
I'm sorry, because we really...
It's not easy for me to
do. Okay. The question for that, No, this is there is no doubt that this is a very different technique of meditation. Because instead of, in a way, resting in the moment, it's like, into the moment. And at that level, I think you have a tendency to fall asleep. In this one, you can't fall asleep. This is very good at that level, generally. I mean, the Korean, of course, can fall asleep at any time. So, it is true that, in a way, sometimes for some people, this method is not very good, because actually it starves their intellect instead of resting. So, at that level, I would not recommend it. Sometimes. So, in a way, each of us has to see. But I would say, sometimes in daily life, when you really feel stuck, and you say, what is it? Actually, it moves, things move. So it has very much this very direct moving quality, which is, in a way, yes, quite different from what we kind of assume with meditation, a very calm quality. But actually, if you do this meditation regularly over a long period of time, you get to the same stability. It is just too, but question of temperament. See, I would recommend for people to choose one that is meaningful, they can do relatively easily, it seems to work for them. And I would say, just do that. Let it be the breath, the sound, the body, according to your condition, do that. And then, when necessary, when you think, you know, something is easy, then just for a little while, you can bring another one. But the reason I brought all the different techniques, this is more for your daily life. In terms of meditation, yes, generally it's better to do just one or two things on the moon. But in terms of your daily life, I think all these methods I presented are useful in daily life. That's why I'm presenting it. So you get a little training here. And instead of like a tool, you have more tools in your meditative toolkit. And then, in daily life, when appropriate, you can bring these
tools. I think it's worth pointing out that in the way Buddhism is presented, particularly Buddhist meditation is presented in our West modern world, it's very often reduced to a single sort of technique. But in my training in the Tibetan tradition, if you train in the Theravada tradition, you're actually given a whole range of approaches. There's something reductive about saying, well, my practice is doing X as opposed to Y, and trying to boil it all down to one exercise. I think that fails to appreciate the richness and the complexity of tools. The Buddha spoke of 37 limbs of enlightenment. 37, not just one. And that, to me, I feel is, in a way, showing how we need to find a tool, as Martin says, that responds and is appropriate to a given situation, rather than assuming there is one size fits all that we just sort of bang away at. And thereby, sometimes find ourselves doing something that isn't working very well. So to have a range of approaches, I think, is actually a very important thing, but to be careful that as soon as we got a little bit bored with one, we hop to the next. That's just sort of, you know, a sort of dilettante approach. We need to cultivate each tool, but in order that we can apply these different approaches in appropriate situations at different times in our lives and in different situations. And we have to stop.
And maybe tomorrow we'll start with your question. No, next.
Yeah, that's okay. Je dis simplement qu'en effet...